Greetings, fellow Portlanders. From the Emerson News Network, this is Legion of News.
And greetings to you, my friends. From high above the milk packing district in the heart of beautiful Southeast Portland, Oregon, this is Legion of News. It's like I can make you cough just by turning on the microphone.
Can't you? Yeah.
This is Legion of News, a one-hour distillation of all important knowledge from everywhere. My name is Rick Emerson alongside Don Taylor, who is, even now, readying a vast swath of happenings for your edification, including but not limited to the following.
The reward in the Kyron Horman case is now $50,000. A Clackamas woman is suspected of killing her husband. And the man who murdered John Lennon is up for parole again.
As always, have no doubt that this conglomeration of factual discourse and ideological screed will render you shocked, amazed, enraptured, and demonstrably more intelligent than when this hour began. And now, without further ado, I give you Legion of News.
Good afternoon. I'm Don Taylor, and this is absolutely everything you need to know for Wednesday, July 28th, 2010. The reward in the case of missing 7-year-old Kyron Horman was increased this week to $50,000, thanks to an anonymous donor. The missing boy's birth parents, Desiree Young and Kane Horman, attended a news conference with Chief Deputy Tim Moore and Captain Monty Reiser with the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, the lead investigative agency in the case. Young's husband, Tony Young, was also in attendance. Deputies didn't reveal details about the investigation, but said about 11,000 hours have been committed to it, and 3,500 leads have developed from thousands of tips. We continue to ask the community to look for Kyron and continue to provide tips, Moore said. I understand that the public continues to be concerned for Kyron and curious about details of this case. It's a natural tendency for us all to care about the welfare of a small child.
Was there any actual news at this press conference?
No, we were promised that the press would be able to ask questions and that they would provide new details. And apparently the only thing that they said was that there's now they've bumped up the reward to $50,000.
All right.
That was it.
And I don't really know. I don't know much about much, as they say. I'm not a learned man in most ways, but it seems to me, and I say this based simply and solely on my many years of watching homicide Life on the Street, that when you bump up the reward, all that happens is you get a greater number of crazy people coming out of the woodwork saying, "I know what happened to him," or the people who just, they want the reward or they want the attention or they want the whatever. And so they just start saying that they know stuff that they really don't know.
Well, and also, most of my knowledge of law enforcement comes from watching, CSI and stuff. And I always think about how, this case particularly makes me think about how they always say that the parents and such should get on TV and keep saying the kid's name and make sure they humanize him so that, like, then the crazy person's less likely to carve him up or whatever. And all I can think of is that must be what this is about, because it seems like, every other day these people are on TV, they had the guy said, "We believe Kyron's disappearance involves criminal behavior because his parents have been deprived of their son for 53 days. The mother was visibly emotional, said, "We're still very hopeful that with additional tips each day and their diligent actions that this will lead us to Kyron. We love you, Kyron. Never give up hope. We're all coming to get you." So is that what this is? It's just really about them getting on TV yet again, thinking if someone has snatched him, they're going to watch this and...
Maybe, but I don't know anything, but it seems like if you're the kind of guy who, whiles away the dullness in your life by kidnapping children, it seems a little iffy to me that you're going to be swayed by somebody getting on TV and saying his name a lot.
And it never seems to work on CSI or Criminal Minds or whatever.
Such idiots.
Doesn't work on the TV.
No. But I wonder, if he is still alive, exactly what could the plan be?
If he's still alive, what would be their working theory? Did she sell him?
That's exactly what it is.
She got the $350,000 that her husband doesn't know where she got it from to pay her lawyer.
We should actually just call the police department and demand that they investigate the "did she sell him" angle. The Nancy Grace raised that issue, and by God, we want to investigate it. All right. Here's Dawn Taylor at the Legion of News news desk.
A 70-year-old Clackamas woman was arrested Tuesday on suspicion of fatally shooting her husband. Sheriff's deputies said Carol Jean Schreiner surrendered to detectives at the Clackamas County Jail in Oregon City at about 10:25 a.m. She was arrested on suspicion of probable cause of murder. On Friday afternoon, deputies were called to the 8800 block of the Southeast Shadow Brook Court to investigate a suspicious death. They found 73-year-old Richard Meisner Schreiner dead at the scene. Deputies said an autopsy determined the man died from a gunshot wound. Carol Jean Schreiner is scheduled for arraignment today at 3 p.m.
What is it? Shadow Brook Court? Shadow Brook... What,
Southeast what Shadow Brook Court.
That sounds like a euphemism for heaven, like a place you go... You know, like how your dog dies and goes to the Rainbow Bridge. You know, Grandpa dies and he goes to Shadow Brook Court.
And the woman, her mugshot, she looks neither crazy nor even particularly concerned that she's been arrested for murder.
Yeah,
she just looks like some woman who works at the DMV who's peeved that you're taking too long.
Honey, I don't have all day. If you don't have the proper documents, you're going to have to come back tomorrow. That's just the way it goes. That's exactly what she looks like. She looks as though she's thinking, you know, if you cause me to burn my pot roast, I am going to carry a grudge forever. That's what it is. It's a low-grade concern. All right. Here's Dawn Taylor. By the way, I'm sorry, before we continue, I should actually point out that this program will be archived at iTunes and at pdx.fm as well. Also at legionofnews.com. And if you'd like to take a little bit of Rick and Dawn in your pocket with you, wherever you go. You can listen to this fine broadcast via mobile.pdx.fm. Mobile.pdx.fm. Here is Dawn Taylor.
Arizona's controversial immigration enforcement law takes effect tomorrow. Opponents say it promotes racial profiling. Supporters say the law is needed because the federal government isn't doing the job. John Morton with the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, can't comment specifically on the Arizona law, but explains their focus. Other way.
Turn the teletype.
We focus on making our border secure, and we focus on giving some integrity to the system, and we do focus first and foremost on people who pose a threat to public safety, national security, who are criminal offenders.
Wait a minute. So he's from where?
He's from ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
Like being the man from UNCLE. Is that an actual organization or is it a nutcase organization?
No, it's a real organization. They're the immigration people.
Because sometimes the name, you know, sometimes it's like the crazy groups have names that sound, it's like when you get spam, you know, from somebody and they'll say like the International, you know, Legislative Authority, you know, Resolution Commission, wants your PayPal number, you know, or whatever. They want your...
They're the guys that come pouring out of the black van. And all of the Hispanic fellows start yelling, "No migra, no migra," and just scatter. That's ICE.
This artistic representation of what happens when the U.S. Immigration Office comes to town, brought to you by Dawn Taylor. They're not like militia guys. International Customs and Enforcement.
No, this
immigration
is the, this, these are their government.
The
agents.
Actual the government. Okay,
yes.
All right.
Are you sure that was the right one? Because I also, the next thing I have says, ICE says their focus is keeping the borders secure, which is what he just said.
Yeah, well, how many ways are there to
say
that?
And then you got this other quote that says borders.
Let's see what it says.
We're just serious about enforcing the law, but doing it in a way that makes sense and takes into account the fact that we don't have enough resources to remove every single person who's here.
So there you go.
Okay.
Talk about just bailing out the ocean with a thimble.
So that happened, yeah.
It's, never mind. I mean, seriously.
I like it when you start to tackle an issue and then just go,
see, there again, it's like I almost want to get myself all cranked up about it, but it doesn't matter. Like, in the grandest scheme, it doesn't matter because clearly we're not, it seems to me, just from my vantage point, by the way, I'm in a room where I can't see outside, and I'm in front of a Formica table. So from here, though, the figurative view is just, we clearly aren't serious about doing anything about it. So why are we doing anything about it? That's kind of my thing. Is it, you know, it's like poverty or cancer or drugs. We're clearly not actually invested in solving any of those issues. So why bother to spend a dollar if you're not going to spend the $1 billion it takes?
And then we've got that gigantic statue with that thing on it about the poor and the tired and the weary who yearn to breathe free and everything and how they should come here. So It seems kind of we're sending a mixed message.
No, because here means Ellis Island, which is how you get into the country legally. That's the thing. I mean,
well, you don't think the Statue of Liberty, you don't think it represents the United States as a whole?
I think it represents the United States as a whole, but I don't necessarily think it means, like, you can just drop everything and come on over and we'll feed you. I don't think there is no...
I mean, I don't... There, those kind of details... I don't think are not spelled out on the plaque.
Well,
I think they're just
maybe there
just,
needs to be a larger disclaimer.
I mean, it's not like, you know, bring me your tired, your worry, yearning to breathe. BYOB.
Bring your own. I don't know. There's something for that word to need to work comedically. There needs to be something with a B that I end that with. Bring your own
bacon.
Burro.
Burrow.
No, I got nothing.
See,
so
that's just racist.
So. No, so it's like here's the thing. It's just from a logistic point of view, we either want to stop it or we don't. And if we want to stop it,
that's the thing is that it isn't that cut and dried. You know, immigration
but it is,
tries.
But it is. That's the thing is. It's like the law. Like you can never enforce a law 100%. Everybody acknowledges that. But my point is, they're either just giving it lip service. Or they're not. Like the drug war, we're never going to win because it's ridiculous. Because you're never that is the thing where you have to have legalization at some point because a prohibition is never going to work. But at the very least, you can say that they're not just giving it lip service. I mean, because they are throwing like money and troops and whatever. I mean, it's absurd. It's a waste of money. But at the very least, they say, well, we're going to have a war on drugs. And then they kind of do some stuff that backs that up, however misguided it might be. The idea that we're going to do something about illegal immigration is just whether that's right or wrong. We're just clearly not, because if they really wanted to do something about it, you would do what every other country does and just have like a big physical border. You'd have a big wall, that it's just a thing that they say that they're not actually ever going to do anything, you know, about. So, you know, whatever. Yeah, what do I know? All right. Here's Don Taylor.
John Lennon's killer, Mark David Chapman, is up for parole for the sixth time, just months short of the 30th anniversary of the former Beatles' death. Chapman is scheduled to be interviewed by two members of the parole board during the week of August 9th. Four letters were submitted against Chapman's release this year, according to a representative of the New York State Division of Parole, and there were two letters in support. The last time Chapman was up for parole, in 2008, the New York State Division of Parole issued a release saying Chapman's request was denied, quote, due to concern for the public safety and welfare. He was also denied parole in 2000, 2002, 2004, and 2006.
I want to know who the two people are that wrote letters urging that he be released. That's the most interesting thing to me in this story. I mean, you know, he's obviously a lunatic and, you know, whatever. And I think Yoko, Yoko and Paul a couple years ago, they were two of the folks, they wrote like a joint letter.
She's written letters in the past asking that they deny his parole.
Yeah, but I want to know who it is that sits down, writes a letter, addresses it, stamps it, and sends it off. That's not like a thing you do in the spur of the moment. That's several steps.
One could be his wife, Gloria.
Is he married?
Who has been married to Mark David Chapman for 20 years.
Wait
so let's do the math there.
20 is less than 30, though, Don.
And they're allowed conjugal visits.
How is it that he's allowed conjugal visits and then, you know, speaking of the war on drugs, and then like your average drug felon isn't allowed? This country is just effed. This country is just effed in so many thousands of ways.
Now, that's a healthy relationship, though. The woman who meets and marries Mark David Chapman, like after he's been in jail for like a decade.
You know, the thing about Mark David Chapman is it would be one thing if Lennon hadn't. He actually took the time to autograph the guy's album. That's the insane thing about it. That is just, it's just being ungrateful is what that is. He doesn't even have that to point to. Well, he wouldn't sign a record. I mean, at least that in some cracked, insane, funhouse way would make some sort of sense, some perceived slight. He took the time out of his busy goddamn afternoon. He could have been getting a bagel or something. He said he's autographing a record for some jackass who's just going to come back and play him a 45 of his own. So it's just... It's not a world that makes sense anymore, Don. It's just not. You know who is crazy, by the way, is that chick that married Richard Ramirez. You ever seen the interview with her?
Wouldn't really have to. I think just married Richard Ramirez pretty much lays the groundwork for crazy.
I want to see a whole documentary about her. I would almost finance it just so I could watch it.
I remember, though, during the Hillside Strangler trials, though, seeing the footage of the groupies who would go to the courtroom and hang out and... just and moon over him, and that was just so disturbing.
Yeah,
because he I mean, it's not, you know, you see somebody like Ted Bundy. Ted Bundy was a handsome, very charming, very charismatic guy. Richard Ramirez was skanky and creepy and scary.
And had a pentagram carved into his hand, by the way.
Yeah.
And had rotted teeth. That was the other thing. I remember the rotted teeth and the AC/DC hat and the hand that said, Satan. Which, you know, maybe some chicks go for that. The girl who was married to Richard Ramirez, her name is maybe Debbie something or other. But I saw the interview with her, and she's so creepy because she looks so normal. She looks like a school teacher, and I don't think she was. But she looks like a librarian or a school teacher type. And, you know, she had some, like, off-the-charts IQ. And every interview you see with her, she looks like some sort of a Holly Hobby type. She's got this very sort of, dowdy's the wrong word, but a very sort of, homemaker style look to her. Yeah, and she looks like she ought to be, you know, like she'd be some suburban mom, like maybe in the early 80s. She kind of got long blonde hair or whatever.
Yeah.
But she's apparently like freakishly intelligent. But then you see her interviewed, and she's just got like dead doll's eyes. Like her mouth moves and sound comes out, but there's just nothing going on there. It's like she's just got buttons jammed into her where normal people would have like windows to the soul. That's just a window into like it's just like a window into an alley, and in the alley is nothing but a dumpster and a rat and like an old Impala that doesn't run anymore. There's just nothing going on there. And she talks about, well, I know he's a really, really good person, and someday we're going to be together. And you can just hear the vacuum going on inside her brain, where there's just like a spiraling void of mad hattery.
Wow,
it's all very, which is kind of hot in its own sort of way. Here's Dawn Taylor.
A black bear, attracted by the smell of a peanut butter sandwich, managed to open the door of a car in Denver, Colorado, climb in, and got stuck, knocking the gear stick into neutral and sending the car rolling down a slope into trees.
Whoa, whoa, whoa.
The blare of the car horn alerted the members of the Story family, who realized 17-year-old Ben's Toyota was no longer parked in the driveway of their home. When they went to explore, they discovered the car and the trapped bear at the bottom of the hill. The bear's teeth were bared, and his claws were tearing through the car's interior. The bear was trapped inside the car for 2 hours before police were able to release the animal, who ran off into nearby woods. Ben and his sister Becky said the bear was likely lured into the car by the peanut butter sandwich that was left in the back seat.
That's one of those things where you can just tell you're not going to get your deposit back.
A picture of the bear trapped in the car tearing up the seats.
Oh, that is awesome. I mean, there's no amount of detailing, no floor mat is going to distract from this. Oh, wow. I wonder if you're just sitting there just watching a bear destroy your car and you're thinking to yourself, I didn't anticipate this when I woke up this morning.
I really shouldn't have gone with just the liability insurance because I'm not covered for this.
Oh, I like the idea that when the bear sort of doesn't know what else to do, its default mode is to destroy whatever's in the immediate vicinity, which I sort of admire.
That's
I like that.
Pretty much what bears are built for.
Kind of a wanton destruction, just as a... you know, sort of a placeholder behavior-wise.
Excellent. Angry now.
Must kill everything within sight. All right, there you go.
Teeth bared, claws
tearing through the car's interior.
Yeah. What time was it when we started this?
4:45.
4:45, because I realized that the time is different. So.
We have actually, it was 4:44 when we started the theme music, so we've been on the air for about 18 minutes right now.
18 minutes. Are we going to edit this out for later?
No.
Confusing people who are listening.
Yep.
A father and son were arrested in connection with a hit-and-run crash near Sun River, Oregon. Deschutes County Sheriff's deputies said they and Oregon State Police were dispatched at about 9:30 p.m. Monday to South Century Drive and Spring River Road on a report of a hit-and-run crash with injuries. Deputies said the suspect vehicle, a 1988 Ford Bronco, left the scene, and the victim's 2001 Ford Focus was found about 40 feet off the road. The investigation led a deputy and trooper to 23-year-old James Bilbro IV and his father, 56-year-old James Bilbro III.
Bilbro.
At a home in Oregon, Water Wonderland.
Sounds like a 1% joke. I'm sorry. I'm doing the Nimoy thing there. Yes?
And they live in some place called Oregon Water Wonderland.
Are you sure that's not just a place that resides in their head?
I don't know. James Bilbro IV
Bilbro.
Was arrested on suspicion of probation violation and was cited for failure to perform duties of a witness to an accident. His father was arrested on suspicion of drunken driving and failure to perform the duties of a driver involved in an accident.
Maybe it's like living in a winter wonderland. You know, it's just a state of mind.
Oregon Water Wonderland.
Maybe they carried around with them the way the Sioux carried the Sioux Nation around with them, Don.
Maybe.
You don't even know what I'm talking about.
I'm trying to do math in my head.
What are you trying to figure out?
When to do entertainment news and science news?
You could have just asked me.
Oh.
When do we normally do science news? 20 after?
About 25 after.
So we do it at 5:10.
Okay, 5:10.
And then we do entertainment news when?
About 45.
So we do that at around 25.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, so there you go.
I feel better
now. About 30. About 5:30.
30.
Yeah, make it 30.
Okay.
All right, there you go.
Thank you. An Oklahoma judicial candidate is fending off a political attack from his daughter, who has taken out local newspaper ads urging voters, do not vote for my dad.
That is fantastic. How old is she?
She's an adult. She's married. McLean County judicial hopeful John Mantooth's daughter and son-in-law paid for the quarter-page advertisement, which features a picture of the daughter's family, highlights cases in which Mantooth has been sued, and lists a website the couple started called www.donotvoteformydad.com. Mantooth said the bad blood stems from his 1981 divorce from his daughter's mother. This is a family issue which should have been kept private, he said Monday. I'm very sad about this.
Is this one of those things where he was putting it to his secretary and the daughter still carries some grudge about it?
Well, I'm really not sure. Apparently he, Jan Schill, 31, said she's never had a good relationship with her father and doesn't think he'd make a good judge. We just felt it would be bad if he were to become a judge, she said. I assumed he would not appreciate it, but he's made so many people mad. I'm just another mark on his board of peoples he's had a beef with. Andrew Schill said he... There are too many people in this story. Okay, Mantooth suspects political maneuvering. He said his son-in-law, Andrew Schill, was once law partners with one of his opponents in Tuesday's primary, Greg Dixon. It's a very strange set of circumstances, Mantooth said. Mm-hmm. For a person to believe that Greg Dixon had nothing to do with this is like trying to believe that cows give chocolate milk.
I lost interest in this story a while back. About 5 seconds after you said there were too many people, I also came to the same conclusion. And
but for whatever it is, there's a website, donotvoteformydad.com.
Watching you try to read that story and the escalating levels of frustration that activity it caused, I just kept waiting for you to bare your teeth and then start destroying the car's interior. It's like at any moment, dawn smash, and just sort of, you know, just tearing the studio apart. You are listening to Legion of News right here at PDX.FM, right here on this glorious sunny Wednesday, right now. Couldn't be sunnier outside.
No, it's very sunny.
You'll be able to listen to it on your mobile device as well, mobile.pdx.fm. And, of course, it's archived at legionofnews.com as well as at pdx.fm. Coming up at 1 o'clock over at rickemerson.com, the Rick Emerson radio program. And that will feature such bits of whimsy as Don Taylor's top five concert experiences of all time. We'll start to Kelly Clark from Willamette Week. And it will continue a little bit of our Mad Men recap that started yesterday. This is Don Taylor at the Legion of News News Desk.
A woman was killed Tuesday afternoon after a police cruiser ran over her legs at a Cincinnati park. Police said Joanne Burton may have been sleeping under a blanket near a pathway through the park. An officer driving through the Over the Rhine Park on routine patrol veered off a service road in the park and felt a bump. Police said the officer stopped his car, got out, and found that his cruiser had run over Burton's legs. Deborah Gross said she witnessed the accident. She was under the car, Gross said. She crawled out from under the car, tried to stand up, and boom, right back down.
And what?
Boom.
Okay. Not so much a bang or a pow or a shpladoinkle.
No, a boom.
Boom. Okay.
Police said Burton appeared to have suffered minor injuries and was taken to University Hospital to be examined, but she died at the hospital. She was a good sister, said her brother, Jerome Burton. She never bothered anybody.
Wait, was she a homeless woman, or was she just sleeping in the park, like, for no reason?
No, I think she was homeless.
Okay.
Her brother said she minded her own business, and I don't know why she got killed now.
It sounds like they were really close.
The Greater Cincinnati Coalition for the Homeless said Burton was homeless and lived at a nearby shelter. The police chief, Tom Stryker, said driving through the grass is not prohibited for police on patrol in Washington Park. When you have dry conditions like this, the ground is hard as a rock, he said. It's not unusual for an officer to go through a grassy area to look around.
You would think that looking around would entail looking through the windshield, though, and seeing if there was actually somebody in the path of your car.
Maybe not running over people.
I mean, it's homeless, but it's not like she was camouflaged, I wouldn't imagine. All right. Well, what are you going to do? You are listening to Legion of News. This is Don Taylor at the Legion of News News Desk.
Let's do that science news, shall
we? It's time for Science on the March, a proud production of Legion of News.
The United Arab Emirates has declared BlackBerry smartphones a potential threat to national security, saying the devices operate beyond the jurisdiction of national laws and are open to misuse. The move raises concerns of another attempt by the government to control the flow of information in the Arab Gulf nation, which actively censors websites and other forms of media seen as harming national security. This is the second major controversy over a BlackBerry in the UAE. A year ago, the Middle East country's biggest state-run mobile operator was caught encouraging unwitting BlackBerry users to install software on the devices that could allow outsiders to peer inside. The government has never fully made clear what happened in that case.
So the United Arab Emirates is confusing to me because that makes it sound like it's a whole bunch of countries, but it's just one. Isn't the United Arab Emirates, isn't that a country?
Oh, Rick.
It's like when they talk about the Confederated States of Micronesia, which I guess, but that's actually a bunch of islands, so it almost makes sense. United Arab Emirates, I do believe, is a single entity, and yet it's got this totally confusing name that makes it seem like a league of Arab nations somehow, coalition.
It does sound like that.
Yeah, but I don't think that's the case. I mean, that really is the only thing in the story on which I can seize because, you know.
Well, it's a federation of seven emirates situated in the southeast of the Arabian Peninsula, Rick.
What is an emirate, though? Is it a country? Is that a smaller country?
It's a...
A peninsula. Is that not an island, though, right? Wait, what's a peninsula? What's an isthmus? My God, what have I done?
An emirate is a political territory that's ruled by an emir, hence being called an emirate.
Well, that's a circular definition. That
a dynastic Muslim monarch, an emir.
A dynastic, so it is. So it's a... Okay, let me understand this. So it is, in fact, it's a monarchy. It's a theocracy. It is a monarchic theocracy that is part of a federation of similarly governed states.
Right. And then the United Arab Emirates is a constitutional democracy. That is formed of seven.
It's a constitutional democracy in which you can't have a BlackBerry. Uh-huh. All right. There you go. Our partners in peace.
The Telecommunications Regulatory Authority voiced fears that the BlackBerry manages data in a way that could allow it to be misused. BlackBerry devices were singled out because they're the only phones operating in the country that automatically relay users' information to privately managed data centers overseas.
Okay. Well, there you go.
So there you go. 4 million Americans are dependent on wheelchairs, Rick. Now, America's newest auto company, Vehicle Protection Group, is manufacturing an automobile that is wheelchair accessible. CEO Dave Shembri says the MV1, which stands for First Mobility Vehicle, will go on sale in 2011 for under $40,000. And you have some audio for this.
What is the name of this cut? Built. I'm sorry, let me turn down our science. There's too much science going on. I can't hear the audio.
The first vehicle has been built from the ground up for wheelchair accessibility, and the only vehicle that's factory produced that meets the requirements of the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Well, here's the thing about that is that it maybe isn't, you know, it might not be a large audience, but if you can get 100% of that dollar,
yeah,
that's a lot of money right there.
Yeah.
Again, a lot of folks in wheelchairs for various reasons. And here's the other thing. The other thing that he probably, that they know but will not say out loud is that, I mean, this is a horrible thing, but it's true. Is it every time the U.S. just has some ill-advised war somewhere, they know that in 10 years there's going to be a whole other market for guys with no legs that need to be able to get to the plaid pantry for something. And
hence those Danish guys inventing the robot pants.
It's the robot pants, and it's the guy, who's that dick that created the Segway? Dean Kamen, is that his name?
Sure.
The guy that created, back when it was so called the It, and they talked about his other inventions, and he had this weird, this like, it was pretty awesome actually. It was a motorized wheelchair that could do stairs.
Yeah, I remember that.
It was
that.
Righteous. It's way cooler than the Segway is. The Segway, which is basically just one of the, it's, you know, really is, you know, it's just like two, it's like two, like half a little lawnmower. But the wheelchair that can do stairs was just mind blowing. I remember watching that thing and just thinking, well, that's astounding. So the robot pants, yes. And also, what with all the, as Wilford Brimley would say, the diabetes that is just laying waste to, you know, to the baby boomers. You're gonna have a whole generation of people can't walk anymore.
Oh, well.
Because the first thing, you know, when you get diabetes, then they, it's like they just take an axe to your legs, basically. Yeah. I mean, that's the, you know, they just wilks you right into a chair. So
I was going to look this up, but there's no real reason because we're on the radio. But I have this issue of
when has that ever stopped us from doing anything?
The issue of the National Enquirer, and there's an ad that has Wilford Brimley in it, and I swear to God, Wilford Brimley is dead. And they just have some guy who's a Wilford Brimley impersonator, because the guy only barely looks like Wilford Brimley, but he's supposedly Wilford Brimley.
Do you know that Wilford Brimley was at one point a bodyguard for Howard Hughes?
I did not know that.
He
used to be like a rodeo guy.
Here's
didn't
what
he?
A badass Wilford Brimley is. He was a bodyguard for Howard Hughes. He was a ranch hand, like a professional ranch hand, and like a wrangler for a living, but then also participated in rodeos. He was also a blacksmith, which just seems righteous. Like, because at a blacksmith, like, I always just picture him just like clang on an anvil, like the Mark 7 logo guy. And he did something else that was just like astounding. I think he was actually a rodeo clown at one point, too.
He'd be a great guy to have on your side after the zombie apocalypse.
After the apocalypse.
Yeah.
So they,
unfortunately, though, diabetes has withered away his body and... No,
yeah, but then he'd be on the same. But see, but then he and the zombies would sort of be on the same level. You know,
that's
it's a, sort of a, you know, they'd be evenly matched.
He might be zombie proof if his diabetes is bad enough. He might not taste good to them.
You know, he was on an episode of Homicide a while back. It was actually many, many years ago. But I was watching a few weeks ago where he was some guy with a terminal disease, and it was this whole. Yeah, kind of heavy-handed episode about mercy killing and so forth, because his nephew ends up shooting him in the head because he wants to die or whatever. And I've just decided that I'm going to form a metal band called Wilford Brimley Begs for Death. So you go. We're coming to your town.
So the mobility vehicle guy, Shembri, says he took a man in a wheelchair recently for a ride and got his reaction.
What is the name of this cut?
Reaction.
I'm sitting in the front seat using the cup holder, looking out the front window of this car. He says, I can't even remember the last time I did that. And it was a big deal for him.
So there you go.
Well, it's not
cup
like people
holder.
It's not like, there you go, the cup holder. It's not like folks in wheelchairs can't get into cars now. Although I guess it's expensive to have the car modified, maybe, or to have it have it customized. You know, here's the, like my father-in-law, no legs at all, and yet drives himself to the store because he's got a whole thing with like levers and handles and whatnot. So, but I guess it's a little pricey, especially because if you're going to be in any sort of larger vehicle, you got to get like one of those Tommy lift things or something's installed.
Yeah.
So,
and it could get stuck, and then you'd be like Terry O'Quinn on Lost, and you have to fling yourself off of it onto the front lawn and not be able to get into your wheelchair, and you'd have to wait for Peg Bundy to show up and help hoist you up.
It's exactly like that. Is that the end of Science on the March?
Yeah, it is.
All right, there you go. You've got that look on your face today, like you're wondering why you took this job.
I just feel a little bit, little bit off today. Things are a little bit.
It sounds
goofy.
Fantastic.
Oh,
from where I'm
at. Oh,
yeah.
Great.
I could be incorrect in my assessment, but I don't. But really, in the end, my assessment is the one that matters, Don. And I think you sound flawless. You are executing everything you do with style and panache.
Ah, thanks. Gosh. Two people were killed and one was seriously injured when a rare tornado struck a family ranch in northeastern Montana, the Sheridan County coroner said Tuesday. The National Weather Service in Glasgow, Montana, confirmed that a tornado touched down 9 miles west of Reserve in Sheridan County about 7:15 p.m. Monday. Stephen D. Smith, 46, and Robert Richardson, 10, were found dead at the scene, the coroner's office confirmed. Emergency crews found Smith 200 feet from the home. Richardson was discovered in the basement. Coroner Dave Fulkerson attributed their deaths to blunt force head and chest injuries. They died very quickly, he said. Richardson's grandmother, Barbara Smith, 71, was also found in the basement of her demolished home with unknown injuries. She was taken to Sheridan Memorial Hospital in Plentywood, Montana, and later moved to a hospital in Billings. She's listed in serious condition. The storm started about 5:30 p.m., a senior forecaster with the National Weather Service said. It was, quote, kind of on-again, off-again, tornado-producing storm, he said. It died down almost 3 hours later in North Dakota.
I can think of a few things weather-wise that are more unnerving than the idea of an on-again, off-again tornado-producing storm. Because that's just sort of a, the gods just throwing down the dice and going, well, we'll have five of them. Go. Did we have a tornado here a couple years ago? Some sort of a funnel cloud? I mean, it didn't do a lot of destruction, but there was like the funnel clouds. They were not too far from here?
Yeah, we get occasionally, like, little tiny tornadoes that don't do a lot of damage.
Right? I mean, it's not like, they're laying waste to everything, but that's enough to unnerve you. That's one of those moments where you realize just how little we control around here. You know, it's just that, anytime nature gets bored, it'll just create one of those things just to come through and destroy your neighbor's house. All right, here's Dawn Taylor.
Investigators out with the National Weather Service. Wait a minute, this is another tornado story. Investigators with the National Weather Service said a tornado touched down just north of the intersection of Susan Lane and Highway 89 in Surry County, North Carolina, Monday evening, tracking south, then lifting just north of the Raven Knob Boy Scout Camp.
Are we now doing news shows for people who live in Lickskillet, Montana?
I just liked this one because there was a 1.5 mile long swath of damage, and about 400 Boy Scouts were staying at the Boy Scout camp where the tornado touched down. Some of whom were in tents, and they had to move to nearby shelters to avoid the tornado.
So what wasn't, I mean, but it didn't demolish the Boy Scout camp, it just sort of went through.
No, it was near the Boy Scout camp.
That's one of those things about tornadoes that you always hear about, and I wonder if it's true or if it's just a thing that, it's just a thing that has been drilled into us by the popular culture depiction of tornadoes. That whole business of how, you know, there's two houses next to each other, and like the tornado just like shreds the one house into kindling and the other one is untouched. And I wonder if that's, it doesn't seem like that could possibly be true. Except like in the rarest of circumstances. Because even if it only touched down on the one house, it seems like it creates, it's like when you're draining the water in a sink, the drain's in the middle, but it affects everything around it. There's that, you know, whatever it is, you know, but it sort of has a widespread effect on the air around it. So it seems like it would do damage, you know, in a far-flung sort of way. But there's that whole notion that it can just pick things out almost, you know, discreetly to destroy, and then it just leaves everything else intact.
I think it's based on how good of a person you are, Rick. If you're a good person, your house is spared. If you're evil, the tornado destroys your home.
I don't think that's true, because every one of these guys that you see, like in Alabama, getting on television talking about how a tornado destroyed his home, he's always busy thanking God. I mean, I guess it could be a retroactive sort of conversion, like an atmospheric cyclonic version of a deathbed recantation or something. But it seems like they're always very into God. You know, but that's me. That's as God is lifting up their home and flinging it into the next county along with their children.
Well, that's when you escape from the serial killer and the serial killer didn't cut your throat, and you're weirdly grateful to him for sparing your life.
Okay, all right, sure.
Did I just compare God to a serial killer?
Well, he's more of a mass murderer, but okay,
yeah,
sure.
Okay. Let's do some entertainment news.
Here's your entertainment news for Wednesday, right here in Legion of News.
Former child TV star Lance Kerwin has been placed on 5 years probation after pleading guilty to a theft charge. Kerwin, who played the title role in James at 15 on NBC in the 1977-78 season, was given credit during last Thursday's sentencing for 90 days served and ordered to perform 300 hours of community service. Kauai County Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Lauren McDowell says the 49-year-old Kerwin was caught falsifying documents to obtain state medical assistance and food stamps. Defense Attorney Craig DaCosta says when Kerwin applied for the benefits, he omitted in the application that he owned 3 properties on mainland Hawaii. Kerwin says he has paid $21,822 in restitution.
How is it that he owns 3 properties on mainland Hawaii? What is he making his money from? Because James at 15, and I think it does actually say this in the article, it was like one year, right? It was a single season.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like that was back when residuals were really paying you hand over fist. There was no DVD market. There was no secondary market for that show. Not like it was huge in Japan or something. So how is it that he, I'm not saying he's doing anything untoward, but it seems odd that he would be able to own 3 properties in Hawaii.
Anything I could guess right now would be really inappropriate.
What was the actual sentence that he got? That was like a suspended sentence, or did he?
He got credit for having already served 90 days and has to perform 300 hours of community service.
So I can't do the obligatory hack journalist. James at 15, 10 with good behavior. no sports.
You can't do that.
Damn! All right, here's Dawn Taylor.
TV host and zookeeper Jack Hanna says he took his own advice and used pepper spray on grizzlies that were headed toward him. The Columbia zookeeper and frequent David Letterman guest said he was with his wife and other hikers in Montana's Glacier National Park on Saturday when they saw a mother bear and two large cubs coming toward them. Hannah and the others moved slowly back up the trail to a clearing and stood still while the mother and one cub passed by. Hannah says the other cub, weighing about 125 pounds, charged towards the hikers. Hannah sprayed the bear in the face with pepper spray, and it fled.
See, that's what I like, is when you see a guy like that who works hand in glove with nature and has a keen understanding of animals, obviously cares about animals a great deal. But that guy knows. A bear comes at you, you go right back at the bear with the pepper spray. It's not a, you know, he's not like the boy, was there ever a more satisfying moment in film history when that grizzly man guy got eaten?
That documentary is awesome, though.
It's
about the crazy grizzly man guy and how through the whole thing you're just going, oh, man.
And you just know how it's going to end.
You're just a crazy loser.
Yeah.
And then the bears eat him.
It's just so deeply gratifying when, you know, at the end, it says, well, we've got his dying screams as he realizes how misinformed he was about everything. Jack Hanna does multiple shows, though, right? Isn't he? Hasn't he one of those things where he's become like his own brand? He's kind of like the crocodile
Maybe,
guy,
yeah.
Where he's just got a whole bunch of, because he sort of picked up the cultural mantle from Marlon Perkins when Marlon Perkins quit doing the Mutual of Omaha thing. So he was somewhere between Marlon Perkins and Steve Irwin. Who is the new Steve Irwin?
Maybe that Man versus Wild guy.
Maybe, or that creepy daughter of his, Bindle, or whatever her name is.
Yeah.
All right.
Jack Hanna had recently filmed a message for the National Park Service encouraging hikers to carry pepper spray.
Excellent.
So he was well aware of what he should do.
Well done, sir.
Casey Affleck, Ben Affleck's brother, sexually harassed a female producer by telling a male crew member to show her his penis, discussing his sexual exploits, and locking himself and Joaquin Phoenix inside her bedroom to have sex with two other women, according to Amanda White, who claims this in Superior Court. When White objected to the above, she says Affleck retaliated by refusing to pay her a living wage or the $50,000 producer's fee she expected to get for her work on the documentary I Am Still Here, The Lost Year of Joaquin Phoenix. The documentary focuses on the actor's efforts to recast himself as a rapper. While she worked on the project in 2008, White says she was subjected to repeated incidents of offensive conduct based on her gender. Affleck allegedly called women cows, and after learning White's age, asked, isn't it about time you get pregnant? White says Affleck inappropriately suggested she and a crew member have a baby together. He also tried to manipulate her into staying in his hotel room in Costa Rica and grabbed her in a hostile manner when she resisted, she claims. Yeah, and there's more, but, you know.
So Casey Affleck, I'm back on the first sentence here. Casey Affleck allegedly asked a crew member to show this woman, and you say his penis. Is it the crew member's penis or Casey Affleck's penis? Because that's sort of taking lazy entitlement to a whole new level. If you can't even be bothered to unzip your own pants.
Well, White, the director of photography Magdalena Gorka, and the nearly all-male crew allegedly headed to a hotel suite. There were 35 people in the suite, according to the lawsuit, including several prostitutes and male transvestites. White says the shoot had nothing to do with the project, and Affleck had orchestrated it for his own personal gratification. At one point, one of the male crew members commented inappropriately that Magdalena Gorka should have played the part of one of the transvestite prostitutes. She says she only endured the harassment as long as she did because she needed the work. Langdon also made unwanted sexual advances towards Gorka, such as referring to the size of his penis, asking Gorka out on dates, and discussing sexually explicit conduct.
You would think that one of the benefits of being Casey Affleck or being a celebrity of any kind is that you don't really have to work that hard. It seems like that's a lot of effort expended for very little payoff there. He's not really getting anything at the end of that. It just seems like a disproportionate expenditure of energy.
Yeah.
And at the end, he's not getting laid still.
And she basically says also she's never been paid for the work she did on the film. She wants $2 million for the unpaid wages, producer's fees, and screen credit she was supposed to get. And says, this whole sexual harassment thing was pretty bad as well.
Yeah, who could have possibly seen that working on a movie about Joaquin Phoenix's career as a rapper would end badly for you? It's almost hard to believe. You know, it's really satisfying when someone who you always suspected was kind of a dick sort of reveals themselves to be that. See Joaquin Phoenix?
Yes.
Who you could just tell was an a-hole, like, from day one. I mean, there was just no... there was just no hiding it. I mean, it's just, I think he tried to sort of cover that up with, you know, with quirkiness and with sort of like a, like he tried to fabricate this kind of dark, brooding exterior, when really, he was obviously just a prick.
Yeah.
And so this seems to bear that out to some degree. And so I was like finding out at whatever point, you know, that I was right about that. So, all right. Are we done with entertainment news?
Oh, I have one more, which is not especially interesting either. But what the heck? Leanne Rimes' bachelorette pad is going from love nest to full-on family home. E! News learned that Eddie Cibrian and his children are moving into Rimes' Hidden Hills house in Calabasas next week. Eddie and the kids are moving in with Leanne to save money since Eddie lost his CSI job, says a source. Mason is moving into the dog's old room, and Jake is moving into Leanne's office. Considering how much money Leanne Rimes has, this house sounds awfully small.
And it's funny how you can just take the girl out of the trailer park, but she still ends up with a guy who has no job, and one of the kids has to live with the dog.
Rimes purchased the home, which is a few blocks from where Eddie lived with his soon-to-be ex-wife, shortly after the two went public with their relationship last year. It looks like Cibrian is already carrying his weight around the house. Sunday, Rimes tweeted, "Eddie showing me how to do yard work. Think it's the first time I've ever paid attention to yard work."
Okay.
Yeah. So that
How
happened.
Does Leanne Rimes make money at this point?
I think she still tours and does music and stuff. She doesn't. She did. Well, she met him starring in some Lifetime TV movie.
Oh, well, I guess that makes sense because it's not like I'm that exposed to mainstream country radio at this point, but I can't remember the last time she had a sizable hit of any kind. I mean, she was very much, you know, that is all tilted very heavily toward the beginning of her career, all of her big record sales. Although, who knows? I mean, she was a child star, but at a point in American history where I think parents were maybe a little more wise to the ways of finance. So that might be a thing where she's still making money off that, you know, off the money she made when she was like 13 or 14.
She also has one of those very strange faces that I can never quite figure out what it is she looks like exactly.
She looks like a girl who used to be cute. That's what she looks like. She looks like a girl on whom the talent agent bet incorrectly. That's just my assessment.
Well, new on TV tonight, Wednesday, the season premiere with the actual series debut of Plain Jane. Described by the folks at Entertainment Weekly as what you get if you cross The Bachelorette with Super Nanny and What Not to Wear, where they take some woman who is nice-looking enough but apparently not glammed up and make her go on dates in clothes that they dress her in and teach her how to flirt.
Okay.
Yeah. On America's Got Talent, and no one cares about that. Actually, the only interesting thing on TV tonight, frankly...
You could not possibly seem less invested in this segment. There is no way. Your dearth of interest is actually so profound.
Okay, there is a show. There is one TV show on tonight that I'm really interested in. It's on Animal Planet. It's called Animal Hoarding. And it's about the... This one focuses on a guy who's going to stop supporting his estranged wife's 87 dogs.
Let me ask you this. If I were to guess that you were just at any moment here, just inches away from falling into a horrible fit of the giggles that cannot be stopped, would I be correct in that assessment?
You might. You might be.
Okay, just checking. It seems like you might have reached that.
Yeah.
Might have reached that time of the day.
The Emerson Show later should be a lot of fun. Also, I'm also almost out of news, and anyway.
Nah, it's going to be fine. If you need a little pick-me-up, I got a packet of Famous Amos cookies in the other room. Hey, by the way, don't forget the Rick Emerson Show is coming up at 1 o'clock today. We'll be talking to Kelly Clark from Willamette Week. We'll also have today's top five, Don Taylor's top five concert experiences. We'll do a little bit of a second half of our Mad Men recap, and you know, sort of what, 2 or 3 days behind, depending on how you look at it. But there is a sort of reason for that. So we've got that coming up. We've got watches to get to, I think, Clown Watch, Geek Watch, Taser Watch. That is on the way and happens over at rickemerson.com. Comes up at 1 o'clock, and if you are not a subscriber, you can do that for only 32 cents a day. That is the low, low cost for really just... Really, entertainment that you would probably have to. You'd probably have to sell some of your organs for that, you know, most other places. Don't forget, one of the reasons that this program right here, Legion of News, exists for your amusement is because of folks like Michael Beatty. He is the proprietor of The Cleaning Solution. And I'll give you his number right up top, and I'll repeat it again at the end. It's 971-533-3333. 972-571-533-3211. And it's funny, I actually, he said that he had been sort of a listener of, you know, the Rick Emerson Show and its various incarnations, and that he was a listener of Legion of News since we came on. And I said, really, is that so? And he actually noted, when I talked to him on the phone, he actually had to set the phone down at one point because he had something like, 17 cases of Viso in his garage. That he had purchased and he had stacked up or something. And he was like, moving the cap collection around because he was going to be redeeming them for something. So, in any event, he's a longtime listener. And of course, he's a Portland, he's a Portland resident and it's a local company. And they not only are a Portland company, but all of their suppliers, all of their equipment, all the stuff they use when they come to clean your carpet or they clean your rug or they, you know, you've got like a problem with your tile or something, or if you've got, you know, some staining in sections of the house, maybe from pets or whatever, all of their equipment, when possible, comes from Portland. And he's, you know, keep it in his advertising money right here, too. So do give him a call. Tell him you heard it right here. His name is Michael Beatty at The Cleaning Solution. 971-533-3211. This is Don Taylor.
A passenger has been left stunned after allegedly being kicked off her flight so an overweight passenger could have an extra seat. The woman, who wishes to remain anonymous, said she was removed from her seat on a Southwest Airlines flight from Las Vegas to Sacramento last week so that an obese 14-year-old could have two seats. Weighing just 107 pounds, the passenger paid full fare for her last available seat on the plane. She alleges that she got on board and sat down only to be told to get off the plane immediately. "It didn't seem right that I should have to leave to accommodate someone who only paid for one seat," she told the U.S.'s Sacramento Bee. The woman also said the staff berated her when she asked why she had been booted from the plane. She said the airline should have been more considerate. A spokeswoman for Southwest Airlines says it intends to apologize to the woman over the incident. "We know this was awkward, and we should have handled it better."
Well, that's interesting. They actually don't even deny it, though. That's, you know, in other words, that they didn't say no comment, and they didn't say, well, there were additional issues at play, or the full circumstances have not been discussed. You're only getting part of the picture, or she's taking it out. They actually just said, "Well, sorry about that. What are you going to do?"
Well, usually it's a normal policy to ask for volunteers if a flight is overbooked and see if somebody will give up a seat. It sounds like since this woman, particularly, she was the last ticket, somebody mistakenly sold her a seat when they weren't supposed to. And so then they sort of scrambled and, "Oh, I'm lady, sorry. Oops."
Right, but
and that's just bad form.
Well, but my thing is, so it's the 14-year-old, so it's so that, you know, it's Heather has two mommies and whatever, Brianna has two seats, apparently. So if the story is, if it was actually that they were booting her out of the seat, so some corpulent 14-year-old could sit down next to her, that's the part of the story that it's interesting they didn't deny. Because I would think that wouldn't be legal, first of all.
Well, and particularly since Southwest Airlines is the airline that went through that nonsense with Kevin Smith recently.
Oh, that's right.
I forgot that
they were the airline at play there. So, what was the actual resolution of that?
I'm not sure. I mean, I know that basically what happened, you know, someone decided he was too fat and he shouldn't be in one seat, and even though he's not that fat. And he didn't have any problem getting his seatbelt buckled or any of that nonsense. It ended up being this nonsense where he ended up being asked to get off the plane because Southwest Airlines, apparently their policy is if you're fat, you should take up two seats.
Now, when you say he's not that fat, I was going to say, it's been a long time since I've seen a picture. The last time I saw Kevin Smith visually, but, you know, the last time I saw him, it's when he was guest hosting Dinner for Five because Favreau was doing something or other, and he was like a planet. I mean, he was huge. He was massive.
I'm fat, but I can fit in an airline seat.
You could fit like five of you inside Kevin Smith. I mean, it was serious. And I'm not trying to knock the guy. I mean, whatever. He's rich and famous. He can be fat. Doesn't matter to me. I don't care. He can wear a hockey jersey. He can be fat. I don't care.
He did demonstrate to the stewardesses, the steward eye, that he could fasten his seatbelt without an extender.
Oh,
and so,
okay.
He should have been allowed to stay in the seat.
No, I'm with you on that. Okay. Yeah. Well, maybe he's lost weight. Boy, you know, Favreau himself, though. I wonder if it's just like sitting in that seat that makes you huge. Because Favreau, it's like somebody hooked him to an air hose. I mean, somebody
has
just...
Yeah, but have you seen him lately,
no,
though?
No,
since he started directing, and then he's also in the Iron Man movies. Oh, no.
Did he drop it?
He's in shape. He's in scary good shape. Like, it's like, what happened to you, Favreau? You're like hard as a rock. It's freaky.
It's just fascinating, the massive weight gain and weight loss that happens sort of in the world of the famous. Because you always wonder, like, what is the backstory there? Like, I just picture him with a rag between his teeth, manacled to a table, as some guy says, like, look, it's all going to be worth it when you see yourself on the red carpet. And then you just hear, like, some awful clanking machine being wheeled into the room. And then the camera pulls back and he's just sort of like,
you know? And he's paying somebody $500 a day to make him work out 4 hours a day and eat like nothing but, salad and wheatgrass juice.
Is that true? I mean, or are you just sort of speculating?
No, I'm speculating.
Well, I mean, it's got to be something.
That's pretty
like
that. Much how it happens.
Well, that's the thing that always annoys me so much about Oprah is that Oprah is constantly like bleeding that she's unable to lose weight, that's just a big load.
She's not unable to lose weight. I mean, she's obviously lost weight before. The thing is, Oprah is someone who has a body type that is obviously supposed to have some padding on it. And her body keeps going back to that. You know, it's...
Well, it's not like her body's getting up without her brain in the middle of the night and going and eating an angel food cake.
Yeah, but, you know, this sounds like I'm justifying this because I am a fat person. But, you know, people do have wildly different metabolisms and wildly different ways that they process and manage food and weight. And there are different body types. Oprah is not someone who is naturally supposed to be thin.
I don't disagree with that.
And also, the more you diet, particularly, this is a problem a lot of women have, the more you diet and then go off a diet and then go back on a diet and go off a diet, you end up just screwing up your insulin response to the point where you gain weight really, really, really easily. Because your body just basically, as it goes, oh, you're starving me again? Okay, I'm just going to hold on to every calorie you give me.
Your body becomes a Depression-era grandparent.
Your body becomes a very efficient fat storage system.
Hide this in the attic.
Because it doesn't know when it's going to, it's going to be devastated by starvation again. So, yeah.
The best part is... The longer we do this show, learning what subjects or areas of discussion will do the thing where you actually start hitting the table while you talk. where the table vibrates because you're...
Sorry.
People just don't understand. All right.
I'm sorry.
We gotta wrap this up, and I think we're actually going to do it... we're going to wrap up a couple minutes earlier than we might normally because we want to be able to... let's get ourselves into a hole. We're going to paint ourselves into some sort of a chronological corner here. So let's do one more, and then we'll bring the curtain down on this.
Police warnings about the dangers of holding the Love Parade in the German city of Duisburg were not heeded. The police union chief said, with the nation in shock over 19 deaths in a stampede. They died when panic broke out at the techno music festival last weekend in the western city near the Dutch border. Many Germans were baffled that such a tragedy could occur in their highly organized and closely regulated country.
How could a lot of people die in Germany? It seems like they're such an efficient group of people.
Chancellor Angela Merkel expects a scrupulously thorough investigation into the tragedy, her spokesman Ulrich Wilhelm said in Berlin. Authorities raised the number of injured to 511, with 43 seriously hurt and one in critical condition. I warned them a year ago that this was not a suitable location for the Love Parade, said Rainer Wendt, a senior police officer and head of the National Police Union. It's too small and too cramped. The Love Parade originated in Berlin with a population of 3.4 million and was held in a giant park in Germany's largest city until 2006. The city where it's now held has a population of 500,000. So, Love Parade.
I think we can all agree that Germany is not a place for love parades ever at all.
Have you ever seen footage of the Love Parade?
No.
Oh, yeah, it's crazy. Yeah. It's a techno music festival, crazy people, topless hippies. Kind of a parade.
Germans terrify me.
It's nutty.
Germans just scare the hell out of me. I've always thought that the Borg were some sort of an allegory for the it's like Germans. It's like the country just can't help itself either. It's like, about 80 years, will pass, and they manage to keep it under control, and then it's like they just have to start killing everything around them, It's like they can keep it under control for the better part of a century, and then suddenly they just have to, it's like when you haven't eaten for a while, and then you just shove the first thing in your mouth that you see. It's like the first country they see, we'll invade that, So we're due. I mean, really, I'm saying within the next 10 or 20 years, just keep your eye on them. That's all I'm saying, because they're crafty. And we should do this and end that. Legion of News, brought to you each and every weekday by PDX.fm and originates from the studios of the Emerson News Network. At the news desk is Don Taylor. Advanced technology and magic provided by Thomas Gill. Our executive producer, Bruce Agler. And of course, chief of staff is Cheryl Kanakoa. The Rick Emerson Show begins next at rickemerson.com. This has been another exciting episode of
Legion of News on PDX.fm.